The Marching Season, Disc 7.
28. Hartley Hall, Norfolk. By all appearances, it was a typical winter's day at Hartley Hall. The weather was clear and bright, the air fresh with the scent of the sea. After lunch, they drove to Clay in Douglas Cannon's official car and walked the sands of Blakeney Point, bundled in their overcoats and wool hats. The North Sea sparkled in the brilliant sunlight. The special branch bodyguards walked quietly behind them while Nicholas Hartley's retrievers terrorized the terns and Brent geese. Rain moved over the Norfolk coast at dusk. By the time the dinner guests began arriving, the storm had matured into a full-fledged North Sea winter gale. It was just after 10 p.m., when Gavin Spencer slipped from the blind in the Northwood and hurried through the trees back to the beach. He opened the trunk of the Vauxhall and removed the canvas duffel. He carried the bag across the campsite and rapped on the door of the caravan. Rebecca Wells parted the curtains in the window next to the door and peered out. She opened the door and Spencer climbed into the caravan. The wind blew the door shut behind him. The tiny space was crowded with the members of his unit. Spencer had personally selected the team, and he knew each of the men well, James Fletcher, Alex Craig, Lenny West, and Edward Mills. The air was thick with cigarette smoke and the smell of nervous men who had been sleeping in tents for 2 days. Fletcher and Craig sat at the small galley table, West and Mills on the edge of the bed, faces unshaven, hair disheveled. Rebecca was making tea. Spencer placed the duffel on the floor and ripped open the zipper. He removed the Uzi submachine guns one by one and passed them to the men, followed by ammunition clips. A moment later, the caravan was filled with the sound of metal on metal as the team shoved the clips into their Uzis and worked the sliders. Spencer took the last weapon and tossed the empty duffel onto the bed.
"Where's mine?" Rebecca said.
"What are you talking about?"
"My gun," she said. "Where is it?"
"You've no training for this sort of thing, Rebecca," Spencer said softly. "Your work is done." She slammed the teapot onto the table.
"You can make your own bloody tea, then, can't you?"
Spencer moved forward and put a hand on her shoulder. "Now's not the time for this," he said softly. "I put our chances of success at 1 in 2 at best. A couple of these lads might not make it home again. Don't you think you owe it to them to keep your head in the game?" She nodded. "All right, then. Let's get down to business, shall we?" Rebecca opened the cabinet above the stove and took down a large folded piece of paper. She spread it on the table, revealing a detailed map of Hartley Hall and the surrounding grounds. Spencer let Rebecca handle the briefing.
"There are several entrances to the manor house," she said. "The main entrance, of course, is here." She tapped the diagram with her fingertip, "at the south porch. There are also entrances here in the orangery, here and here on the east wing, and the main service entrance here. Each night I circled the house and took note of where lights were burning. The night of the ambassador's arrival, I noticed a light burning in a bedroom for the first time here, on the first floor. I suspect Cannon is sleeping there."
Spencer stepped forward and took over. "I want to overwhelm them. I want to create confusion. We approach separately and enter the house simultaneously at 4 a.m. I'll go in the front. James will enter through the orangery. Alex and Lenny will enter through the east wing, and Edward will go through the service entrance. Some of us will meet resistance. Some of us won't. As soon as you're inside, head straight upstairs to the guest bedroom, and the first one to arrive puts a bullet in the ambassador. Any questions?" The dinner guests began leaving just after midnight. Though they were not dinner guests at all, but a collection of MI5 watchers and desk officers, actors in the illusion of Operation Kettledrum. When the last had gone, the 2 special branch bodyguards went off duty, and 2 new officers came on. One made a cursory tour of the grounds, dressed in foul weather gear like a North Sea fisherman. The light burned in the Chinese bedroom until 1 a.m., when Michael slipped into the chamber and doused it. The members of the SAS team had slowly filtered into position outside the house.
One lay in wait in the walled garden, another in the deer park, a third lay in the parterre, and a fourth in the cemetery next to St. Margaret's Church. The rest took up positions throughout the ground floor of the house. Each soldier wore infrared night vision glasses and a miniature radio with an earpiece that would allow him to communicate with the nerve center inside the mansion. Each carried the standard-issue SAS compact submachine gun, the HKMP-5, as well as a Herstal 5.7mm handgun for backup. The Herstal is regarded as one of the world's most powerful handguns. It fires 2-gram bullets at a muzzle speed of 650 meters per second and is capable of penetrating 48 layers of laminated Kevlar, the substance used in protective body armor, from 200 meters away. Michael carried the CIA's standard-issue handgun, a high-powered Browning 9mm with a 15-shot clip. Graham Seymour was unarmed. The two men waited in the control room, upstairs in the first-floor guest bedroom. The weather was playing havoc with the electronic sensing equipment. The motion detectors were sounding constantly because of the twisting of the trees and shrubbery. The high-powered directional microphones were overwhelmed with the roar of the wind and the hammering of the rain. Only the infrared video cameras were functioning properly. At 3:30 a.m., MI5 field agents stationed in the campgrounds around Hartley reported movement by the members of the assassination squad. The field agents did not follow the terrorists. Instead, they allowed them to proceed unhindered toward the estate. At 3:55 a.m., camera operators on the top floor of Hartley briefly spotted 2 gunmen moving into position, one in the trees bordering the deer park, a second creeping across the ruins of the village toward St. Margaret's Church. At precisely 3:58 a.m., James Fletcher rose from his hiding place in the parterre and moved quickly along a gravel footpath toward the orangery. Before joining the brigade, Fletcher had been a member of the Ulster Defense Association, a violent Protestant paramilitary organization. Indeed, he had been one of the group's most prolific assassins, with a half-dozen confirmed kills of IRA gunmen. He had broken with the UDA when it agreed to a ceasefire during the peace negotiations. When Gavin Spencer approached him about joining a new group, the Ulster Freedom Brigade, he had accepted without hesitation. Fletcher was virulently anti-Catholic and believed Ulster should be a Protestant province for Protestant people. He also desperately wanted to be the one to murder the ambassador, so he went into action 2 minutes early, disobeying Spencer's order to wait until 4 o'clock. Fletcher wore a balaclava, a black jumpsuit, and rubber-soled black athletic shoes. As he padded along the footpath, the gravel crunched softly beneath his feet. He reached the French doors and tried the latch. It was locked. He took a half-step back and rammed the butt of the Uzi through the pane nearest the latch. Shards of glass rained down on the stone floor. He was reaching through the empty pane when he heard footfalls on the gravel behind him. He removed his hand and placed it on the Uzi. He was about to spin around and fire when an English-accented voice said, "Drop the gun and put your hands on your head, there's a good lad." Fletcher quickly calculated the odds of winning the encounter with the man standing behind him. If he was Special Branch, Fletcher almost certainly possessed more firepower, though the Special Branch protective officers were notoriously good marksmen. He was wearing body armor beneath his jumpsuit, and he could survive almost anything but a headshot. He also knew that if he was arrested, he would probably spend his remaining years in an English jail. James Fletcher dropped suddenly into a crouch and pivoted, raising his gun to the firing position. He saw the man for only an instant, but he realized at once that he was not Special Branch. He was SAS, which meant they had all walked straight into a trap, the same trap the IRA had walked into several times with disastrous results. Fletcher also realized he had just made a fatal miscalculation. The soldier's gun made no sound other than a dull clicking. He knew it had fired, though, because he could see the muzzle flash. The round shredded his jumpsuit and pierced his body armor, shattering his spine and ripping a gaping hole in the muscle of his heart. He fell backward, crashing through the French doors, and collapsed onto the floor of the orangery. The SAS man appeared before him a few seconds later. He bent over Fletcher and brusquely grabbed his throat, searching for a pulse. Then he snatched up the Uzi and moved away, as James Fletcher died.
Edward Mills heard the sound of shattering glass as he raced across the ruins surrounding St. Margaret's Church. He still had the lean, lightly muscled physique that had made him a champion cross-country runner at school, and he scampered easily across the piles of stones and low walls of the ruins. Like Fletcher, he wore a black jumpsuit and a balaclava. Ahead stood St. Margaret's, looming over the graveyard. Mills raced along an ancient footpath leading from the village to the back of the church. He had never done anything like this in his life, yet he felt surprisingly calm. He was a member of the Orange Order. His father had been the standard-bearer for his lodge in Portadown, and so had his grandfather. But he had avoided the paramilitaries until the previous summer. It was then that the Army and the RUC had prevented the Orange Order from marching along the Catholic Garvahi Road in Portadown. Like most Orange men, Mills believed he had an absolute right to march along the Queen's Highway any time he pleased, regardless of what the Catholics might think. To protest the blockade, he had remained in the fields around Drumcree Church for 6 weeks. Gavin Spencer approached Mills there, in the sloppy makeshift campground at Drumcree, and asked him to join the Ulster Freedom Brigade. Now he sprinted across the old graveyard, picking his way through headstones and crosses. He was nearing the lich gate, running effortlessly, when he felt a sharp pain in his left shin. His legs became entangled, and he crashed heavily to the ground, face down. He tried to regain his footing, but a second later a man leaped onto his back, hit him twice on the back of the head, and clasped a gloved hand over his mouth. Mills felt himself losing consciousness. "If you so much as twitch or grunt, I'll put a bullet in the back of your head," the man said. And by the calm tone of voice, Edward Mills knew the threat was not idle. He also felt the sickening realization that they had walked straight into a trap. The man tried to pull the Uzi from his grasp. Foolishly, Mills resisted. The man drove an elbow into the back of his head, and a second later, Edward Mills blacked out. Alex Craig and Lenny West raced across the flat, open grass of the Deer Park toward the east wing of Hartley Hall. The two men were veterans of the UVF, and they had worked together many times before. They moved silently, side by side, guns at the ready. They reached the end of the Deer Park and arrived at the gravel approach to the east wing. Behind them a male voice called out, "Stop, drop your weapons and place your hands on your heads." Craig and West froze, but their hands remained wrapped around their Uzis. "Drop the guns now," the voice repeated. Camping on the beach near Blakeney before the operation, Craig and West had decided that if there was trouble, they would rather fight than be taken into custody. They looked at each other.
"Looks like we've been set up," Craig whispered. "For God and Ulster, eh, Lenny?"
West nodded and said,
"I'll take the one behind us."
"Right."
West fell to the ground, rolled over, and started firing blindly in the darkness. Alex Craig fell to his stomach and fired wildly at the east wing, shattering glass. A second later, he saw the reply in one of the shattered windows, the muzzle flash of a silenced submachine gun. West saw the same thing, low in the deep grass of the Deer Park, but it was too late. A burst of rounds obliterated his head in a flash of blood and brain tissue. Craig had no idea what had happened to his comrade. He turned his fire on the gunman in the window, but a second appeared, and then a third. He realized that West's gun had fallen silent. He turned and saw a headless corpse lying next to him on the gravel. He emptied the first clip, shoved another into the Uzi, and started firing again. A few seconds later, the gunman inside the mansion found his mark, as did the man behind him in the Deer Park. Craig's body was torn apart by gunfire. His final shots, fired by a spasm in his dying hands, shattered the magnificent clock in the cupola of the east wing, freezing the hands at 4:01. Gavin Spencer, sprinting across the gravel drive toward the south porch, heard the intense firefight in the Deer Park. For an instant he considered turning away and heading back to the sanctuary of the North Wood. He had no idea what had just happened to any of his men. Had they penetrated the mansion? Had the special branch bodyguard stopped them? He paused for a moment, mind racing, breath ragged. He listened for more gunfire, but heard nothing except wind and rain. He started running again. He passed between the ornate columns of the south porch and leaned against the door. Again, Spencer paused to listen. The gunfire seemed to have stopped for good. The door was locked. He took a step back and opened fire, closing his eyes against the shower of splintered wood. He drove his foot against the door and it crashed open. Spencer stepped into the entrance hall and paused, Uzi at the ready. A figure appeared in the doorway to the great hall, tall, broad shoulders, helmet, and night vision glasses. SAS, Spencer thought, no question. He spun around and took aim with the Uzi. The SAS man tried to fire his own weapon, but it jammed. He reached for a handgun holstered beneath his armpit, but Spencer fired a burst from his Uzi. The gunfire blew the soldier off his feet. Spencer moved forward and snatched the handgun from the holster. He crossed the great hall and started up the staircase. The radio operator in the command center said calmly, "Base to Alpha 534, base to Alpha 534. Can you hear me? Repeat, can you hear me?" He turned around and looked at Michael. "He's off the air, Mr. Osborne. I think we have a brigade gunman loose in the house." "Where's the closest SAS man?" "Still in the east wing." Michael removed the Browning automatic from his coat pocket. He pulled the slider, chambering the first round. "Get him up here, now!" Michael slipped through the doorway into the darkened corridor and closed the door behind him. He heard Gavin Spencer clambering up the great staircase and crouched, holding the Browning with both hands, arms extended. A few seconds later, he spotted Spencer, mounting the last flight of stairs. "Drop the gun, now!" Michael yelled. Gavin Spencer turned and leveled his Uzi in Michael's direction. Michael fired two shots. The first sailed past Spencer and shattered one of the classical busts along the staircase. The second hit Spencer in the left shoulder and drove him back. Spencer kept hold of the Uzi and fired a burst along the corridor. Michael, armed only with the Browning and with nowhere to take cover, was no match for a terrorist with an Uzi. He turned the knob of the door behind him and dived back into the command center. He slammed the door and locked it. "Get down!" Graham Seymour and the other officers in the room hit the floor as Gavin Spencer, standing outside in the corridor, fired through the wall and the door. Each bedroom on the wing was connected to the adjoining room by a communicating doorway. Michael ran to the doorway and entered the next room. He repeated the move twice more until he found himself in the Chinese bedroom. Outside, in the corridor, he could hear Spencer breathing heavily, obviously in pain. Michael crossed the room and leaned against the wall next to the doorway. Spencer fired a short burst from the Uzi, splintering the door, and kicked it open. As he stepped into the room, Michael struck him in the side of the head with the butt of his Browning. Spencer buckled but did not fall. Michael hit him a second time. Spencer fell to the floor, and the Uzi tumbled from his grasp. Michael leaped on top of him, clutching Spencer's throat with one hand and holding the Browning to his head with the other. Outside in the corridor, he could hear the clatter of the approaching SAS men. "Don't move a fucking muscle," Michael said. Spencer tried to throw him off. Michael pressed the barrel of the Browning into the wound in Spencer's shoulder. Spencer screamed in pain and lay still. Two SAS men pounded into the room, guns trained on Spencer. Graham Seymour arrived a few seconds later. Michael ripped the balaclava from Spencer's head. He smiled as he recognized the face. "Oh my goodness," Michael said, looking at Graham. "Look who we have here." "Gavin, darling," Graham said lazily. "So glad you could drop by." Rebecca Wells watched it all unfold from the blind in the North Wood. The gunfire had ended, and the night was filled with the sound of distant sirens. The first police cars raced along the entrance road, followed by a pair of ambulances. The man had walked straight into a trap, and it was her fault. She tried to control her anger and think clearly. The British had certainly been watching them the entire time. There were probably agents in the campgrounds, agents who had followed her as she reconnoitered Hartley Hall. She understood that she had few options now. If she went back to the caravan or tried to hide in the North Wood, she would be arrested. She had 3 hours before first light, 3 hours to get as far from the Norfolk coast as possible. The Vauxhall was no good. It was back at the caravan, almost certainly being watched by the police. If she was to escape Norfolk, she had only one choice. She had to walk. She picked up her rucksack. Inside was her money, her maps, and her Walther automatic. Norwich lay 20 miles to the south. She could be there by midday. She could purchase a change of clothing, check into a hotel to clean herself up, buy hair dye at a chemist, and change her appearance. From Norwich, she could take a bus farther south to Harwich, where there was a large European ferry terminal. She could take an overnight ferry to Holland and be on the continent by morning. She removed the gun from her rucksack, pulled on her hood, and started walking. March 29, Amsterdam, Paris. Amsterdam was a city Delaroche loved. But not even Amsterdam, with its gabled houses and picturesque canals, could lift the gray fog of depression that had settled over him that winter. He had taken a flat in a house overlooking a small canal running between the Herengracht and the Sinkhol. The rooms were large and airy, with vaulted windows and French doors that opened onto the water, but Delaroche kept the blinds drawn except when he was working. The flat was bare, except for his easels and his bed, and a large chair near the French doors, where he sat and read late into most evenings. Two bicycles were propped against the wall in the entrance hall, an Italian sport racer which he used for long rides in the flat Dutch countryside, and a German-made mountain bike for the cobblestones and bricks of central Amsterdam. He refused to keep them in the lockup outside the house, as the rest of the tenants did. There was a huge black market for stolen bicycles in Amsterdam, even for the rickety one-speed coasters that most people rode. His mountain bike would not have survived more than a few minutes. Uncharacteristically, he had grown obsessed with his own face. Several times each day he would go into the bathroom and stare at his reflection in the glass. He had never been a vain man, but he hated what he saw now, because it offended his artistic sense of proportion and symmetry. Each day he made a pencil sketch of his face to document the slow healing process. At night, lying alone in his bed, he toyed with the collagen implants in his cheeks. Finally, the incisions healed and the swelling went down, and his features settled into a boring, rather ugly stew. LaRue, the plastic surgeon, had been right. Delaroche did not recognize himself anymore. Only the eyes were the same, sharp and distinct, but they were now surrounded by dullness and mediocrity. The security requirements of his trade had prevented Delaroche from painting his own face, but shortly after coming to Amsterdam, he produced an intensely personal work of self-portraiture, a hideous man staring into a mirror and seeing a beautiful reflection staring back at him. The reflection was Delaroche before the surgery. He had to work from memory because he had no photographs of his old face. He kept the work for a few days, leaning against the wall of his studio, but paranoia eventually won out, and he shredded the canvas and burned it in the fireplace. Some nights when he was bored or restless, Delaroche went to the nightclubs around the lights of Pline. Before, he had avoided bars and nightclubs because he tended to attract too much attention from women. Now he could sit for hours without being bothered. That morning he rose early and made coffee. He logged onto the computer, checked his email, and read newspapers online until the German girl in his bed stirred. He had forgotten her name. Something like Ingrid, maybe Ava. She had childbearing hips and heavy breasts. She had dyed her hair black to appear more sophisticated. Now, in the gray morning light, Delaroche could see she was a child, 20 at most. There was something of Astrid Vogel in her awkwardness. He felt angry with himself. He had seduced her for the challenge of it, like making a steep ascent on his bike at the end of a long ride, and now he just wanted her to leave. She rose and wrapped her body in a sheet.
"Coffee?"
she asked. "In the kitchen," he said, without looking up from his computer screen. She drank her coffee, German style, with lots of heavy cream. She smoked one of Delaroche's cigarettes and eyed him silently as he read. "I have to go to Paris now," he said.
"Take me with you."
"No." He spoke quietly but firmly. Once, when he used that tone of voice, a girl like her might have been nervous or anxious to leave his presence. But she just stared at him over her coffee cup and smiled. He suspected it was his face.
"I'm not finished with you," she said.
"There isn't time." She pouted playfully.
"When am I going to see you again?"
"You're not."
"Come on," she said. "I want to know more about you."
"No, you don't," he said, shutting off the computer. She kissed him and padded away. Her clothes were strewn across the floor, ripped black jeans, a flannel lumberjack shirt, a black concert t-shirt with the name of a rock band that Delaroche had never heard of. When she finished dressing, she stood before him and said,
"Are you sure you won't take me to Paris?"
"Quite sure," he said resolutely. But there was something about her that he liked. He said gently, "I'll be back tomorrow evening. Come at 9 o'clock. I'll make you dinner."
"I don't want dinner," she said. "I want you."
Delaroche shook his head. "I'm too old for you."
"You're not too old. Your body is wonderful, and you have an interesting face."
"Interesting?"
"Yes, interesting."
She looked around the room at the canvases leaning against the walls.
"Are you going to Paris to work?" she asked.
"Yes," Delaroche said. Delaroche took a taxi to Amsterdam Centraal Station and purchased a first-class ticket on the morning train to Paris. He bought newspapers at a gift shop in the terminal and read them as the train raced through the flat Dutch countryside into Belgium. The news that morning intrigued him. During the night, a Protestant paramilitary group from Northern Ireland had tried to assassinate the American ambassador to Britain while he was spending the weekend at a country house in Norfolk. According to the newspapers, special branch agents had killed 3 members of the group and arrested 2 others. The alleged leader of the Ulster Freedom Brigade, a man named Kyle Blake, had been arrested in Portadown. Police were looking for a woman connected to the group. Delaroche folded the newspaper and looked out the window. He wondered whether Michael Osborne, the ambassador's son-in-law, was somehow involved in the incident. The director had told him in Mykonos that Osborne had been brought back to the CIA to deal with Northern Ireland. The train drew into the Gare du Nord in Paris in the early afternoon. Delaroche collected his small grip from the luggage rack. He passed through the station quickly and caught a taxi outside. He was staying at a small hotel on the Rue de Rivoli overlooking the Tuileries Gardens. He told the driver to drop him a few blocks away on the Rue Saint-Honoré, and he walked the rest of the way. He checked into the hotel as a Dutchman and spoke accented French to the desk clerk. They gave him a garreted room on the top floor with a fine view of the gardens and the Seine bridges. He slipped a clip into his Beretta pistol and went out. Dr. Maurice Leroux, cosmetic surgeon, kept an office in a fashionable building on the Avenue Victor Hugo, near the Arc de Triomphe. Delaroche, without giving his name, confirmed by telephone that the doctor was in that day. He told the receptionist he would be around later to see him and hung up abruptly. He sat at the window table of a café across the street and waited for Leroux to come out. Shortly before 5 o'clock, Leroux emerged. He wore a gray cashmere overcoat, and he seemed to be the last man in Paris to actually sport a beret. He walked quickly and appeared pleased with himself. Delaroche left money on the table and went out. Leroux walked to the Arc de Triomphe, then circled the Place Charles de Gaulle, and strolled down the Avenue des Champs-Élysées. He entered Fouquet's restaurant and was greeted by a middle-aged woman. Delaroche recognized her. She was a minor actress who played bit roles on French television dramas. The maitre d' showed LaRue and the aging actress into the club side of the restaurant. Delaroche took a small table on the public side where he could see the door. He ordered a hash of potatoes and ground meat and drank a half bottle of decent Bordeaux. When there was still no sign of LaRue, he ordered cheese and café au lait. It was nearly 2 hours before LaRue and his companion left the restaurant. Delaroche watched them through the glass. It was windy, and LaRue turned up the collar of his cashmere coat dramatically. He gave the actress a theatrical kiss and touched her cheek, as if admiring his work. He helped her into a car. Then he purchased newspapers and magazines from a kiosk and started walking through the buzzing evening crowds along the Champs-Élysées. Delaroche paid his check and went after him. Maurice LaRue was a walker. With his newspapers tucked beneath his arm, he walked along the Champs-Élysées to the Place de la Concorde. He had no reason to suspect he was being followed, and therefore tailing him was very easy. Delaroche had only to keep pace with him along the busy sidewalks. The cut of his expensive jacket and the farcical beret made him easy to spot among the crowds. He crossed the Seine at the Pont de la Concorde and walked for a long time on the Boulevard Saint-Germain. Delaroche lit a cigarette and smoked as he walked. LaRue entered a café bistro near the Church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés and sat down at the bar. Delaroche entered a moment later and sat at a small table near the door. LaRue drank wine and chatted with the barman. A pretty girl ignored his flirting. After a half hour, LaRue left the bar, by now thoroughly drunk. This pleased Delaroche because it would make his task easier. LaRue teetered along the Boulevard Saint-Germain through the light rain and entered a small side street near the Mabillon metro station. He stopped at the entrance of an apartment building and punched in the security code. Delaroche slipped in the door behind him before it could close. They entered the lift together, an old-fashioned cage threaded through the middle of the staircase. LaRue punched the fifth floor, Delaroche the sixth. Delaroche chatted about the miserable weather in Parisian-accented French. LaRue grunted something unintelligible. Clearly he did not recognize his patient. LaRue got off at his floor. As the lift rose, Delaroche peered through the grill and watched LaRue enter his apartment. He stepped out of the lift on the sixth floor and walked down one flight of stairs. He knocked gently on LaRue's door. The doctor answered a moment later, face perplexed, and said, "Can I help you?" "Yes," Delaroche said, and he punched LaRue in the throat with a knife-like fist. The blow left LaRue doubled over in agony, speechless, gasping for air. Delaroche closed the door.
"Who are you?" LaRue rasped. "What do you want?"
"I'm the one whose face you took a hammer to." He realized it was Delaroche.
"Dear God," he whispered.
Delaroche removed the silenced Beretta pistol from his coat. LaRue began to tremble violently.
"I can be trusted," he said. "I've done many men like you."
"No, you haven't," Delaroche said, and he shot him twice through the heart.
Delaroche arrived back in Amsterdam early the following afternoon. He returned to his flat by taxi and packed a blue nylon backpack with his painting kit, two small canvases, paints, a Polaroid camera, a portable easel, and the Beretta pistol. He rode his mountain bike along the cobblestone streets to a spot on the Kaisergracht where there was a good bridge with lights on the arches that came on after dark. He locked his bike and walked around the bridge for some time until he found a perspective he liked, with houseboats in the foreground and a trio of magnificent gabled houses in the background. He removed his camera from the backpack and made several Polaroid photographs of the scene, first in black and white so he could see the essential forms and lines of the setting, then in color. He set to work, painting quickly, instinctively, racing to capture the fleeting twilight before darkness took hold. When the lights flickered to life on the bridge, he set down his brush and simply watched. He studied the reflection of the lights on the smooth surface of the canal for a long time. He waited for the painting to cast its spell, waited for the image of Maurice Leroux's dead eyes to evaporate from his mind. But neither happened. A long water taxi slid past, and the reflection of the bridge lights dissolved in its wake. Delaroche packed away his things. He rode along the Kaiserschacht, gingerly holding the canvas in his right hand. In any other city he might have drawn stares with such a pose, but not in Amsterdam. Delaroche crossed the Kaiserschacht at Rehstraat, then pedaled slowly along the Prinzenschacht, until the old houseboat appeared before him. He chained his bicycle to a lamppost, leaned the canvas against the front tire, and hopped onto the deck. The Christa was 45 feet long, with a wheelhouse aft, a slender prow, and a row of portholes along the gunwale. The green and white paint was flaking with neglect. The hatch at the top of the companionway was secured with a heavy padlock. Delaroche still had the key. He unlocked the hatch and stepped down the companionway into the salon, which was dark except for the soft glow of the yellow street lamps leaking through the dirty skylights. The boat had been Astrid Vogel's. They had lived here together the previous winter, after Delaroche had hired her to assist him with a series of particularly difficult assassinations. He could imagine her now, her long body bumping about in the cramped spaces of the houseboat. He looked at the bed and thought of making love to her with rain drumming on the skylight. Astrid had nightmares. She used to pummel him in her sleep. Once she awakened after a bad dream, surprised to find Delaroche in her bed. She nearly shot him before he could wrench the gun from her hand. Delaroche had not been back to the Christa since then. He spent several minutes rifling cabinets and drawers, looking for any trace of himself he might have left behind. He found nothing. There was nothing of Astrid either, just some appalling clothing and a few well-thumbed books. Astrid was used to living in hiding. She had been a member of the Red Army faction and had spent many years in places like Beirut and Tripoli and Damascus. She knew how to come and go without leaving tracks. Delaroche's obsessive independence made him incapable of loving another, but he had cared for Astrid. And, more important, he had trusted her. She was the only woman who knew the truth about him. He could relax around her. They had planned to go to the Caribbean when the job was done, to live together in something approaching a marriage. But Michael Osborne's wife had killed her on Shelter Island. Delaroche climbed the companionway and locked the hatch behind him. He mounted his bike and pedaled toward his apartment through the lamplight. Delaroche killed for two reasons, because he was hired to kill or to protect himself. Maurice Leroux fell into the second category. He had never killed out of anger, nor had he ever killed for revenge. He believed the bloodlust for revenge was the most destructive of emotions. He also thought it was unbecoming of a professional of his stature. But now, cycling through the streets of a strange city, with a face he did not recognize, Delaroche was overcome by a desire to kill Michael Osborne. He saw the German girl waiting on the front steps of the house. He crossed the Herrenschacht to the opposite side and waited. He had no desire to see her again. Finally, she scribbled a note and shoved it beneath the door before storming off along the canal. Delaroche scooped up the note as he entered the foyer, "You are a fucking bastard, please call, love, Ava," and pushed his bicycle into the flat. He entered his studio and dropped the unfinished painting on a stack of other incomplete works. He hated it suddenly. It seemed contrived, unimaginative, tiresome. He stripped off his coat and placed a large blank canvas on his easel. He had painted her once, but the work, like the rest of his possessions, had been destroyed in Mykonos. He stood there in the half-light, thinking about it for a long time, trying to remember her face. There was a Byzantine quality about it, he remembered. Wide cheekbones, a large, mobile mouth, liquid blue eyes set slightly too far apart. The face of a woman from another time and place. He switched on the harsh halogen lamp suspended from the ceiling and started to work. He discarded one canvas because he did not like the pose, and a second because the structure of her facial bones was all wrong. The third canvas felt right from the moment he started to work on it. He painted his most enduring visual memory of her. Astrid leaning on a rusting wrought iron railing on a hotel balcony in Cairo, wearing only a man's galabia unbuttoned to her stomach, the setting sun shining through the thin white cotton, revealing the soft lines of her back and her upturned breast. He worked through the night, until morning. He had polluted his body with coffee and wine and cigarettes. When it was finished, he could not sleep because he had a headache. He carried the canvas to his room and propped it up at the foot of his bed. Finally, sometime before noon, he fell into a restless sleep. 30. London, New York City. Michael Osborne was forced to remain in London for 3 days after the Hartley Hall affair, dealing with the real enemy of any servant of the secret world, the bureaucracy. He had spent 2 days giving lengthy statements to the authorities. He had helped Wheaton clean up the mess of Preston McDaniel's suicide. He had worked with Special Branch to tighten security around Douglas. He had attended a memorial service for the 2 SAS officers slain in the Sperrin Mountains of Northern Ireland. His last day in London was spent in a soundproof cell deep in the catacombs of Thames House, enduring a ritual debriefing by the mandarins of MI5. When it was over, he stalked Milbank in the rain for 20 minutes searching for a taxi, because Wheaton had commandeered Michael's staff car on a dubious pretext. Finally, he retreated to Pimlico Underground Station and took the tube. London, a city he loved, suddenly seemed dreary and oppressive to him. He knew it was time to go home. Graham appeared in the drive of Winfield House the following morning to take Michael to Heathrow, this time in a Jaguar instead of his department Rover. "We have to make a stop on the way to the airport," Graham said as Michael climbed into the back seat next to him. "Nothing serious, darling, just a couple of loose ends to tie up." The car left Regent's Park and headed south along Baker Street. Graham changed the subject. "You see this," he said, pointing to an article in that morning's Times about the mysterious murder of a prominent French plastic surgeon. "I glanced at it," Michael said. "What about it?" "He was a naughty boy."
"What do you mean?"
"We've always suspected he was earning a little extra cash by fixing the faces of bad guys," Graham said. "The good doctor made several house calls to exotic places like Tripoli and Damascus. We asked the French to keep a watch on him, and as usual they told us to fuck off." Michael read the article. It was 2 paragraphs with only the barest details. Maurice Leroux was shot to death in his apartment in the 6th arrondissement of Paris. Police were investigating.
"What kind of gun did the killer use?"
9mm. The Jaguar sped south along the Park Lane, then crossed Green Park along Constitution Hill. A moment later it passed through the gates of Buckingham Palace. Michael looked at Graham.
"Never a dull moment with you, is there?"
"I wouldn't have it any other way." "It's so nice to see you again, Mr. Osborne," Queen Elizabeth said, as they entered a palace drawing room. "Please sit down." Michael sat down. Tea was served, and her aides and assistants withdrew. Graham Seymour waited outside in the anteroom. "I want to thank you for the fine work you did in dealing with the menace of the Ulster Freedom Brigade," the Queen said. "The people of Northern Ireland owe you a tremendous debt. Indeed, so does the whole of Great Britain."
"Thank you, Your Majesty," Michael said politely.
"I was very sorry to hear about your agent, the one who was killed in Northern Ireland."
She paused a moment, face perplexed, and glanced at the ceiling.
"Oh, good heavens, I can't recall the poor man's name."
"Kevin Maguire," Michael said.
"Ah, yes, Harbinger," the Queen said, using Maguire's code name. "Such a frightful business that was.
I was relieved to hear you weren't seriously hurt, but I know losing an agent like Harbinger in such a horrible way must have affected you deeply.
Kevin McGuire wasn't perfect, but there are countless people who are alive today because of him. It took a tremendous amount of courage for him to betray the IRA, and in the end he paid with his life.
What are your plans now that the Protestant threat appears to have been neutralized? Do you plan to stay with the CIA, or vanish back into retirement?
I'm not sure yet, Michael said. Right now, I'd just like to go home and see my wife and children. I've been away for a long time.
I'm not sure I could be married to someone in your line of work.
It takes a very special kind of woman, Michael said.
So your wife is supportive?
Michael smiled. I wouldn't go that far, Your Majesty.
I suppose you have to do what makes you happy. And if working for the CIA makes you happy, I'm sure she'll understand. It's certainly important work. You should be very proud of what you've accomplished here.
Thank you, Your Majesty. I am proud.
Well, since it appears you're going to remain inside the CIA for the time being, I suppose we'll have to do this in private.
Do what, Your Majesty? Michael asked.
Your honorary knighthood.
You're joking.
She smiled mischievously and said, I never joke about something as important as this.
She opened a small rectangular case and showed Michael the Medal of the Honorary Knighthood of the British Empire. It's beautiful, he said. I'm honored and very flattered.
You should be.
Do I have to kneel?
Don't be silly, she said. Just finish your tea and tell me what it felt like to capture Gavin Spencer.
You mean I just had sex with a real knight? Elizabeth said. I'm afraid so.
I think you're my first.
I'd better be.
So what did you two chat about besides Northern Ireland?
We talked about you.
Oh, please.
We did.
What about me?
She wanted to know whether I was going to stay with the agency or vanish back into retirement, as she put it.
And what did you tell her?
I told her I didn't know.
Such a coward.
Watch it, I'm a knight, remember?
So what's the answer?
For one of the first times in my career with the agency, I feel I actually accomplished something. It feels good.
So you want to stay on?
I want to hear what Monica has to say before I make any final decisions, and I want to hear what you have to say.
Michael, you know how I feel. But I also need you to be happy. It's strange, but listening to you for the last hour, you've seemed happier than you have in months.
So what are you saying?
I'm saying that I wish working somewhere other than the Central Intelligence Agency could make you happy, but if it's what you want and you're going to be content, then I want you to stay.
She crushed out her cigarette, untied her robe, and rolled on top of him, pressing her breasts against his warm skin.
Just make me one promise, she said. If you really think October is still alive, let someone else go after him.
He murdered Sarah, and he tried to kill us both.
That's why someone else should handle the case. Recuse yourself, Michael. Let Adrian give the job to someone else, someone with no personal stake.
She hesitated a moment.
Someone who's not out for revenge.
What makes you think I'm out for revenge?
Come on, Michael, don't be dishonest with yourself or me. You want him dead, and I don't blame you, but revenge is a dangerous game. Didn't you learn anything while you were in Northern Ireland?
Michael turned away. She took his face in her hands and pulled him back.
Don't be angry with me. I just don't want anything to happen to you.
She kissed him gently.
Take the advice of your lawyer on this one. It's over. Let it go.
Mykonos. The Executive Council of the Society for International Development and Cooperation convened its spring meeting on the island of Mykonos on the first Friday of March. Delaroche's vacant villa on the cliffs of Cape Mavros served as the site for the gathering. It was too small to accommodate anyone but the director, his bodyguards, and Daphne, so the other council members and their entourages took refuge in the hotels and guesthouses of Cora. At sundown they trickled across the island, the intelligence chiefs and arms merchants, the businessmen and organized crime figures, in a caravan of black Range Rovers. The director and his staff had seen to the security arrangements. There were heavily armed guards around the grounds, and a high-speed motorboat on Panormos Bay filled with former amphibious troops from the SAS. The villa had been thoroughly swept for bugs, and radio jammers broadcast electronic chaff to disrupt long-range microphones. They had cocktails on Delaroche's fine stone terrace overlooking the sea, and a meal of traditional Greek food. At midnight, the director gaveled the proceedings to order. For the first hour, the Executive Council dealt with routine housekeeping matters. As always, the council members addressed each other by their code names: Rodin, Monet, Van Gogh, Rembrandt, Rothko, Michelangelo, and Picasso. The director turned his attention to society operations now underway in North Korea, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Kosovo, and finally Northern Ireland. In February, Monet saw to it that a shipment of Uzi submachine guns reached the hands of the Ulster Freedom Brigade, the director said. Those guns were used in the attempted assassination of Ambassador Douglas Cannon. Unfortunately, they seemed to do no good. The ambassador survived the attack, but the Ulster Freedom Brigade did not. Most of its members are either dead or in custody. So, for now, our involvement in Northern Ireland is terminated. The director recognized Rodin, the operations chief of the French intelligence service. If we wish to renew our involvement in Northern Ireland, there might be an opportunity sitting in Paris, Rodin said. The director raised one eyebrow and said, "Continue, please." As you know, one member of the team involved in the assassination attempt in Norfolk managed to escape, Rodin said. A woman named Rebecca Wells. I happen to know she is hiding in Paris with a British mercenary named Roderick Campbell. I also know she has sworn to even the score after the incident in Norfolk. She is trying to find an assassin capable of killing the American ambassador. The director lit a cigarette, clearly intrigued. Perhaps we should make direct contact with Rebecca Wells and offer assistance, Rodin said. The director made a show of careful deliberation. Ultimately, the decision would be made by the Executive Council, not by him, but his opinion would hold considerable weight with the other members. After a moment, he said, "I doubt Miss Wells could afford our services." "I agree," said Rodin. "The work would have to be pro bono. We'll have to think of it as an investment." The director turned to Picasso, who appeared uneasy. "For obvious reasons, I cannot support an operation like the one that's being suggested," Picasso said. "Support for a Protestant paramilitary group is one thing. Direct involvement in the murder of an American diplomat is quite another." "I understand you're in a difficult position, Picasso," the director said. "But you knew from the outset that some of the actions taken by this organization might conflict with your own narrow self-interests. Indeed, that is the spirit of cooperation embodied by the society."
"I understand, Director."
"And if the Executive Council gives its blessing to this operation, you must do nothing to prevent it from succeeding."
"You have my word, Director."
"Very well," the director said, looking about the room. "All in favor signify by saying aye."
The meeting broke up just after dawn. One by one, the members of the Executive Council left the villa and headed back across Mykonos to Cora. Picasso remained behind to have a private word with the director.
"The Hartley Hall affair,"
the director said distantly, watching the sun appear on the horizon. It was a trap, wasn't it, Picasso?
It was a major victory for our service.
It will make it more difficult for our detractors to say that we have lost our way in the post-Cold War world. Picasso paused, then added carefully, I thought results like that were the goal of this organization.
Indeed, the director smiled briefly. You are well within your rights to act against the Ulster Freedom Brigade in order to further your own interests. But now the Society has decided to help the Brigade carry out a specific task, the assassination of Ambassador Cannon, and you must do nothing to prevent it from going forward.
I understand, Director.
In fact, there is one thing you can do to help.
What's that?
I intend to give the assignment to October, the Director said. Michael Osborne seems to have made it his crusade to find October and destroy him.
He has good reason.
Because of the Sarah Randolph affair?
Yes.
The director looked disappointed. Osborne seems like such a talented officer, he said. This fixation with avenging the past boggles the mind. When will this fellow get it through his head that it was nothing personal, just business?
Not any time soon, I'm afraid.
It's come to my attention that Osborne is in charge of the search for October.
That's true, Director.
Perhaps it would be best for all concerned if he were given other responsibilities. Surely an officer of such obvious talent could be better utilized elsewhere.
I couldn't agree more. The Director cleared his throat gently.
Or perhaps it would be best if Osborne was out of the way completely. He got quite close to us during the transatlantic affair, too close for my comfort.
I would have no objections, Director.
Very well, he said. It's done.
Daphne wanted sun, and the director reluctantly agreed to spend the rest of the day on Mykonos before returning to London. She lay on the terrace, her long body exposed to the sun. He never tired of watching her. The director had long ago lost the ability to make love to a woman. He suspected it was the secrecy, the years of lying and dissembling that had left him impotent. So he admired Daphne as one might admire a fine painting or sculpture. She was his most treasured possession. He was naturally a restless man, despite his placid demeanor, and by the early afternoon he had had as much sun and sea air as he could endure. Besides, he was an operations man at heart, and he was anxious to get to work. They left at sundown and drove across Mykonos to the airport. That evening, after the director's plane had left the island, a series of explosions ripped through the whitewashed villa on the cliffs of Cape Mavros. Stavros, the real estate agent, was the first to arrive. He telephoned the fire department from his cellular phone and watched as flames engulfed the villa. Monsieur Delaroche had given him a Paris number. He dialed the number, prepared to break the news to his client that his beloved home above Panormos Bay was gone. The telephone rang once, and a recorded voice came on the line. Stavros spoke a little French, enough to know that the number had been disconnected. He punched the button and severed the connection. He watched as the firefighters vainly tried to put out the flames. He drove back to Anomera and went to the taverna. The usual crowd was there, drinking wine and eating olives and bread. Stavros told the story.
There was always something funny about this man Delaroche, Stavros said when he had finished. He pulled his face into a smirk and stared into a cloudy glass of ouzo. I knew this the moment I set eyes on him.
32. Paris. Rebecca Wells was living in Montparnasse, in a drab apartment building a few blocks from the train terminal. Since her flight from Norfolk, she had stayed in the appalling flat most of the time, staring at French television programs she couldn't comprehend. Sometimes she listened to news from home on the radio. The brigade had been crushed, and she was to blame. She needed to get out. She picked herself off the couch and moved to the window, gray, as usual, cold, dreary. Even Ulster was better than Paris in March. She went to the bathroom and looked into the mirror. A stranger stared back at her. Her rich black hair had been wrecked by the peroxide she had used in Norwich. Her skin was yellow from too little air and too many cigarettes. The skin beneath her eyes appeared bruised. She pulled on a leather jacket and paused outside the bedroom door, listening to the clang of dumbbells. She knocked, and the clanging stopped. Roderick Campbell opened the door and stood there, shirtless, his lean body shining with sweat. Campbell was a Scot who had served in the British Army, then put himself about as a mercenary and gunrunner in Africa and South America. He had cropped black hair, a goatee, and tattoos over his chest and arms. A naked whore lay on his bed, toying with one of his guns. "I'm going out," she said. "I need some air."
"Watch your back," he said. He spoke with the soft brogue of his native Highlands. "Want some company?"
"No, thanks."
He held out a gun.
"Take this."
The elevator was broken again, so she took the stairs down to the street. God, but she was glad to be out of the place. She was angry with Kyle Blake for sending her to a man like Campbell. But things could be worse, she thought. She could be in jail or dead like the rest of them. The cold felt good, and she walked for a long time. Occasionally she paused in a storefront and glanced behind her. She was confident she was not being followed. For the first time in many days, she felt genuine hunger. She went into a small café and, using her abysmal French, ordered an omelette with cheese and a café crème. She lit a cigarette and looked out the window. She wondered if it would always be like this, living in strange cities surrounded by people she did not know. She wanted to finish what they had started. She wanted Ambassador Douglas Cannon dead. She knew the Ulster Freedom Brigade was no longer capable of handling the job. Effectively, there was no more Ulster Freedom Brigade. If the ambassador was going to be killed, someone else would have to do it. She had turned to Roderick Campbell for help. He knew the kind of men she needed, men who killed for a living, men who killed for no other reason but money. When the waiter brought the food, Rebecca ate quickly. She could not remember the last time she had eaten real food. She finished the omelette and washed down some baguette with the coffee. The waiter reappeared and seemed astonished that her plate was empty. "I was very hungry," she said self-consciously. She paid her bill and went out. Pulling her coat tightly to her throat, she walked the quiet streets of Montparnasse. A moment later, she heard a car behind her. She stopped at a public phone and pretended to dial a number while she looked at the car. A black Citroën sedan, two men in front, one in back. Maybe French police. Maybe French intelligence, she thought. Maybe friends of Roderick. Maybe nothing. She walked faster. She was suddenly sweating in spite of the cold. The driver of the Citroën pressed the gas pedal, and the engine note grew louder. "My God," she thought, "they're going to run me over." She turned her head as the car swept past and braked to halt a few yards ahead of her. The rear passenger side door opened. The man in the back leaned over and said, "Good afternoon, Miss Wells." She was stunned. She stopped walking and looked at him. He had oiled blonde hair swept straight back from his forehead and pale sunburned skin. "Get in the car, please. I'm afraid it isn't safe for us to be talking on the street." He had the accent of an educated Englishman. "Who are you?" she asked. "We're not the authorities, if that's what you think," he said. "In fact, we're quite the opposite." "What do you want?" "Actually, this has to do with what you want." She hesitated. "Please, we haven't much time," the blonde man said, holding out a pale hand. "And don't worry, Miss Wells, if we wanted to kill you, you'd already be dead." From Montparnasse, they drove to an apartment building in the 5th arrondissement,
on the Rue Tournefort overlooking the Place de la Contrescarpe. The blond man disappeared in the Citroën. A balding man with a florid face relieved her of Roderick's gun and escorted her into a flat that had the air of a seldom-used pied-à-terre. The furnishings were masculine and comfortable, black, informal couches and chairs grouped around a glass coffee table, teak bookshelves with histories, biographies, and thrillers by American and English writers. The remaining portions of the wall were bare, with faint outlines where framed paintings had once hung. The man closed the door and punched a 6-digit code into a keypad, presumably arming the security system. Wordlessly, he held out his hand and led her into the bedroom. The room was dark, except for a patch near the window, which was illuminated by rainy light leaking through the partially open blind. A moment after the door closed, a man spoke from the darkness. His voice was dry and precise, the voice of a man who did not like to repeat himself. "It has come to our attention that you are looking for someone capable of assassinating the American ambassador in London," the man said. "I think we can be of assistance."
"Who are you?"
"That's none of your affair. I can assure you that we are perfectly capable of carrying out a task like the one you have in mind, and with much less mess than that affair at Hartley Hall." Rebecca trembled with anger, which the man in the shadow seemed to detect. "I'm afraid you were duped in Norfolk, Miss Wells," he said. "You walked straight into a trap engineered by the Central Intelligence Agency and MI5. The man who ran the operation was the ambassador's son-in-law, who happens to work for the CIA. His name is Michael Osborne. Do you wish me to continue?" She nodded. "If you accept our offer of assistance, we will waive our usual fee. Let me assure you that normally it is quite steep for a job like this. I suspect well beyond the means of an organization such as the Ulster Freedom Brigade."
"You're willing to do it for nothing?"
Rebecca asked incredulously. "That's right."
"And what do you want from me?"
"At the appropriate time, you will claim responsibility for the act."
"Nothing more?"
"Nothing more."
"And when it's over?"
"You'll have no further obligation, except under no circumstances are you ever to discuss our partnership with you. If you do discuss our arrangements, we reserve the right to take punitive measures." He paused for a moment to allow his warning to take hold. "You may find it difficult to move about when this is all over," he said. "If you wish, we can provide services that will help you remain at large. We can provide you false travel documents. We can help you alter your appearance. We have contacts with certain governments that are willing to protect fugitives in exchange for money or favors. Once again, we would be willing to supply these services to you at no charge."
"Why?" she asked. "Why are you willing to do this for nothing?"
"We are not a philanthropic organization, Miss Wells. We are willing to work with you because we have mutual interests." A lighter flared, revealing a portion of his face for an instant before the room was in darkness again. Silver hair, pale skin, a hard mouth, wintry eyes. "I'm afraid it's no longer safe for you to remain in Paris," he said. "The French authorities are aware of your existence here." She felt as if iced water had been poured down the back of her neck. The thought of being arrested, of being sent back to Britain in chains, made her physically sick. "You need to leave France at once," he said. "I propose Bahrain. The head of the security forces is an old colleague of mine. You'll be safe, and there are worse places to be than the Persian Gulf in March. The weather is quite glorious this time of year."
"I'm not interested in spending the rest of my days lying next to a pool in Bahrain."
"What are you trying to say, Miss Wells?"
"That I want to be a part of it," she said. "I'll accept your help, but I want to be there to watch the man die."
"Are you trained?"
"Yes," she said.
"Have you ever killed?"
She thought of the night 2 months earlier, the barn in County Armagh, when she had shot Charlie Bates. "Yes,"
she said evenly. I've killed.
The man I have in mind for the assignment prefers to work alone, the man said, but I suspect he will see the wisdom of taking on a partner for this contract.
When do I leave?
Tonight.
I'd like to go back to the flat, pick up a few things.
I'm afraid that's not possible.
What about Roderick? What's he going to think if I disappear without explanation?
Let us worry about Roderick Campbell.
The blonde man drove the Citroën back to Montparnasse and parked outside Roderick Campbell's apartment building. He got out and crossed the street. He had stolen the woman's keys. He opened the main door on the ground level and walked up the stairs to the apartment. Removing the high-powered Herstal automatic from the waistband of his jeans, he opened the door and quietly slipped inside.
This ends Disc 7.